From the Jesuits of Canada and the United States, this is AMDG. I'm Mike Jordan Lasky. The basic details of Father Walter Chiswick's life sound like a movie. He was an American priest ministering in Eastern Europe around the time of World War II, and then he was arrested by the Soviet Union and falsely accused of being a Vatican spy. He spent time in a KGB prison and more than a decade in Siberian labor camps. His family and his Jesuit brothers back in the U.S. assumed he was dead. During his captivity, Father Chiswick secretly heard confessions. He celebrated Mass, he baptized, he comforted the sick, he ministered to the dying. His faith sustained him through solitary confinement and torture and violent interrogations. The John F. Kennedy administration negotiated his release and he returned to the United States in 1963. In the years following his release, Father Chiswick wrote two books, With God in Russia and He Leadeth Me. The latter book, which is a spiritual memoir, shot up to the very top of Amazon's bestseller list recently, decades after its publication. Why? Well, the extremely popular Catholic prayer app Hallo, which just ran a Super Bowl commercial a few weeks ago, picked He Leadeth Me to anchor their Lenten prayer program this year. It's safe to assume thousands of folks are meeting Father Chiswick for the first time these days. So we thought we'd take the chance to introduce him to AMDG listeners too. I asked Jim Keane to come on the show to talk about Father Chiswick and his legacy. Jim is a senior editor at America Media, where he oversees the book reviews, literary essays, the Catholic Book Club, and the Faith and Reason section. Jim is a fantastic writer and storyteller, and he has written several great pieces on Father Chiswick over the years. So I asked him to share some of his favorite Father Chiswick stories and reflect on why the biggest Catholic smartphone app might have picked He Leadeth Me to read this Lent. You can subscribe to AMDG wherever you get podcasts. And thanks for joining us. Well, Jim Keane, welcome to AMDG. Thank you so much for taking the time. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me, Mike.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about Walter Chiswick. Before we were recording, we were saying how Walter Chiswick has been popping up on our website a lot. People are finding Walter Chiswick on both America's website and our own at the Jesuits. And it's a lot of interest. And that a lot of that comes from the Catholic prayer app Hallo, which had a Super Bowl ad this year. And their Lenten book that they're reading is He Leadeth Me by Walter Chiswick. And they sent it to the top of the Amazon charts for at least a couple of days recently. So we thought it was a good chance to learn about who is this Walter Chiswick? Why is he important? Maybe introduce some of our folks who haven't read him to his story, and maybe we'll add some more totals to his book sales after this episode. So you've written about Walter Chiswick for America and really, I think, shared his story in a super compelling way. And we'll let folks, we'll share in the show notes those links to that. But one of the things you wrote about him that maybe was where we could start is that you wrote about Walter Chiswick. It is impossible to read Walter Chiswick's life story and not want to have met him. Why is that true for you?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a very dramatic story, right? This man spent 20 years either in prison or at forced labor in the Soviet Union, and then returned having been written off as dead by his family and by the Jesuits. But also, I kind of like his backstory a little bit. This is kind of a tough kid from Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. It's coal country. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's sort of outside Scranton and Allentown, that area. And he was in a gang as a teenager, sort of a tough kid, and joined the local seminary and then joined the Jesuits when he was 24. The old Jesuit novitiate and juniorate is in Warnersville, Pennsylvania, so in the sort of neighborhood. And he just seemed like an unlikely character to end up being this kind of important figure in the Cold War, in the sort of history of U.S.-Soviet relations, and then to write these two books, With God in Russia and He Leadeth Me, which are kind of considered to be classics of spiritual memoir, of sort of prison stories and that people do use for Lenten reflection, for spiritual reading.
Yeah. So you think you wrote that his family was kind of surprised when he decided to enter the seminary. So maybe we could start just what do you know about his kind of early time? And so how did he get from like a kid in a street gang in Northeast Pennsylvania to becoming a Jesuit and then eventually ending up in Europe.
Yeah, well, when he entered, so he was ordained in 1937. So this would have been, he would have entered during when Jesuit formation was fairly regimented. So as a 24-year-old coming from a seminary, he would have done 2 years as a novice and then 2 more years as what they used to call a junior. So it was 4 years in this property at Wernersville, which is, you can still go to it today. I mean, it's where he's buried. Mm. There's a Jesuit cemetery there. It's huge. There's a swimming hole. There's fields that they rent out. There's a building with 85 rooms in it. Mm. Just vast facilities, but very rural and sort of kind of out of the way. I mean, I'm sure it was very different from his hometown, which would have been not urban, but a busier place. And the point was really to sort of get you away from the world and kind of iron out some of the maybe bad habits you had developed. Probably pick up a few bad habits there too. But but then he volunteered to do this to work with Catholics in Eastern Europe, and he was originally not sent to the Soviet Union, but sent to Poland in 1938. But of course, in 1939, the Von Ribbentrop Pact. Hitler and Stalin just divide Poland in half. He ends up on the Soviet side of the line, and so then just moved into Russia and was ministering in secret to Catholics and also Eastern Orthodox in the Soviet Union, and then was eventually captured in 1944. At the time, the U.S. and Soviet Union are allies, but he's captured as a foreign spy. The Cold War immediately becomes a big factor as soon as World War II is over. And so they put him in this infamous KGB prison, Lefortovo, in Moscow. And he has these stories that are in He Leadeth Me, With God in Russia, of, you know, one time they took him and blindfolded him and took him out into a yard and pretended to be getting ready to shoot him. And then, 5 years in there, and then he's sent off to the Gulag in Siberia to work in these towns basically at hard labor in these freezing cold places with other political prisoners, with other sort of folks in prison for religious police, for basically anything that Stalin, the Stalinist state found you guilty of. And back in the U.S., they just decided at some point, poor Walter is dead. And so his family sort of gave up on efforts to find him. And, the Jesuits have a book in every house that lists members of the province when they died. And so they're prayed for at Mass every day in the house. It's called the Necrology. Mm. And they finally just put Walter Chiswick into it because they assumed he had died. And then around 1955, his family gets a letter that purports to be from him. They don't know if it's real, and then in the 60s, all of a sudden the story goes, and I will say this, you have to take all Jesuit stories with a grain of salt because they tend to be embellished in rec rooms and classrooms all the time. But the story is that they were negotiating, the U.S. and the Soviets, about releasing this student who had been found guilty of espionage in exchange for these two Soviet spies. And then the Soviet negotiator said, well, if you throw in so-and-so, we'll throw in this Jesuit priest we have. And they were like, what? So the deal was made. Chiswick knew nothing about this. One day the police just showed up and said, okay, come with us. Put him in what they thought was a nice suit and flew him to New York. And of course, he had not seen the United States in 20 years. Suddenly lands at what is now Kennedy Airport. Back then was Idlewild. And there's this huge mob of photographers taking his picture. And then he sees two of his classmates he knew from Wernersville, one of whom was the editor-in-chief of America. So you can imagine just this sort of this crazy story. It almost works as a movie even when you're reading it. It's like scene by scene. You can see it in your mind's eye. Then they drive back to America House, the headquarters of America Magazine, followed by the KGB in a cab. And then he sort of goes into seclusion to stay away from the press, and then sits down with America's literary editor, Dan Flaherty, and works on a manuscript, 1,700 pages long, which eventually is distilled down into With God in Russia. And then, you know, from there, goes back to sort of a normal Jesuit life in some ways, moves to the Bronx, they works at this ecumenical center called the John the 23rd Ecumenical Center in right off Fordham's campus. It's now called Chiswick Hall in his honor. And, you know, lived kind of a quiet life from then on.
So let's maybe dip into that, the manuscript that becomes With God in Russia. You kind of, as you were doing the overview, kind of just blew through those 20 years a little bit. So what is he writing about? You know, what is he, what, so what is he doing? And then like, what, how is it affecting him internally? Like, what are some of the big themes and stories that you remember that stay with you in the book?
Yeah. So there's the story. I mean, a lot, the first part is definitely about his capture and his time in the KGB prison, which is, I remember being a teenager and reading an excerpt from this in, you know, something that came home from church. I don't know if it was Catholic Digest or something, where he's, you know, trying to celebrate Mass using, you know, whatever fruit he can get that he can possibly turn into wine, you know, by fermenting it, raisins or whatever. So he's trying to say Mass. He's trying to keep his hopes up, keep his faith strong. And then the way it works in the Soviet Union is that one day you're just suddenly transferred somewhere else. So he ends up in this town, in this what Solzhenitsyn called the Gulag Archipelago, this series of prison camps. And it's unheated. Everyone lives in a wooden barracks. And he does hard labor. He moves, he cuts down trees, he moves logs, he breaks rocks. But he takes on this sort of ministry of secretly serving as a priest. Can't let anyone know, but hearing confessions, you know, trying to say Mass when he can. And otherwise, just having the persona of, you know, sort of, you know, Joe Sixpack. After a certain number of years, they let him out of the prison camp, but they still stick him in this, in a town in Siberia where he has no contact with anyone, and he goes to work as an auto mechanic. And again, he's being watched, obviously, pretty closely. He has no money, very little food, very little means for communicating with other people, but he's still doing this priestly ministry of Mass, of confessions, of spiritual counseling. And, you know, relying on some of the habits of prayer and contemplation that he had learned back in the United States and that he had used throughout the years to sort of keep his head up.
Yeah, it just seems like, how do you kind of sustain through that for that amount of time without any contact? Does he write about like where he was like finding this strength to continue? Was he like prepared for this from some, like, you know, kind of growing up in tough, you know,
I mean, you have obviously both as himself as a young man, but also in the Jesuits, he would read the stories of saints and martyrs, right? And so especially in the United States, you have the North American martyrs, people like Isaac Joes, Andre Brebeuf, these folks who came to minister to the Native American Indians and were tortured and killed. And then other stories, Xavier going off to be a missionary to the Far East, these various characters. So there's a certain, I think one way to do it is to associate yourself with other people who suffered more. I think another one is just he was pretty strict, no-nonsense guy, which I think a lot of Americans found out when he came back. He wasn't all that interested in being a celebrity, wasn't all that praiseworthy of the United States that he found when he returned. He could be a little bit of a scold, actually, you know, very critical of some things he saw about America. So I think a lot of it was he just had this iron will, and then it was buttressed by this faith, which was fed by contemplation, by imagination, by stories of the faith. So, and, you know, the other thing is, sorry to interrupt you. No. The other thing is that there's not that many Catholics in these camps, but under the surface of this supposedly atheist Soviet system, almost everybody's actually a Christian, you know, Eastern Orthodox something. And so the people in the camps may not be public about their Christianity, but he's not actually living for the most part in, like, you know, an atheist world. You know, the commandant of the camp might have called himself an atheist, but everyone else, you know, would have grown up as a Christian.
Sure. So he's seeing, you know, this faith under the surface in these difficult situations that if it were public could be incredibly dangerous. He'd risk his own life to do this, I imagine, if people had found out that he was, you know, surreptitiously serving as a priest, would not have gone over well.
Yeah, and he talks in the book, he talks in With God and Russia about the danger of trying to get things like a mass book or the elements to celebrate mass, because you never know who's actually a double agent or who's looking maybe to curry favor with someone by snitching on you. And so that was a constant concern for him, who to trust, when to take a risk, when not.
And so, and you mentioned too, like, that he came back then, his return, and then obviously a perspective of a couple of decades there really affected how he saw America and then even how faith was lived out in the U.S. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that return. You have a story you write in one of your pieces that, again, might be apocryphal, but you have been passed down about how when he came back, they weren't even entirely sure it was him. It could have been, you know, a Soviet spy, someone else, because no one had seen him in such a long time. And then they had to figure out a way to try to make sure it was him. So how does that sort of go?
Yeah, well, I think that it was not common, but it was well known that the Soviets would sometimes send someone a quote-unquote defector who actually would be a KGB agent. Mm. And that appears in movies sometimes. But when Chizik came back, he had been working in these labor camps for 20 years. So he's hardened by that. And then his classmates, so Thurston Davis was the editor of America, and then Francis Canavan was another associate editor, and they had known him at Warnersville. But they didn't really recognize him when he showed up. And actually, Davis said the idea of the Russians had kind of dressed him up to look like he was prosperous, but it was crazy. He was like a purple hat and, like, you know, this crazy coat. And so there was some question about, well, is this really him? But they whisked him away to Warnersville the next morning after he arrived. America House, the old America House, was right smack in the middle of Midtown, and the reporters were just everywhere. Everyone wanted a piece of you know, to get the exclusive interview, to hear the story. So they took him out to Warnersville to let him sort of decompress a little bit. And that's actually where he was when he wrote With God and Russia with Father Flaherty. But they also sent him out with one of his classmates. And so you drive onto the grounds of Warnersville, and you can't really see the main house yet when you first arrive. So the classmate just said, okay, Walter, what's over to the right on the other side of that hill? And, you know, he'd say, oh, well, that was that's the swimming hole. And they'd be like, where is the grotto to Our Lady? And he'd say, such and such, said, you know, what room does Father Minister live in? All these things that you could be the most prepared, ingenious Soviet spy ever. You would never know. Hmm. But if you lived there for 4 years as a young man, you remember every detail. So he got it all right. And they're like, okay, it's really you.
Sure. Yeah, just unbelievable. And so when he writes in America in the soon, not that long, within a year of his return, kind of how he has readjusting to the America, and he's noticing something, certainly, like, things that are very different, including, you know, things like food and the amount of food and the amount of food waste and whether faith seems to be strong. It's just kind of, again, coming back after that much time. And again, not like he's reading about things happening in the U.S. all that often. There's not that, probably not much information he has. So yeah, what do we learn from him? Like, what is his perspective when he comes back toward his native country?
Yeah, so he talks a lot in that article from March 1964 about the difference in food. And he says, you know, oftentimes in during his time in the Soviet Union, he would make a pot of, he would boil cabbage and potatoes and maybe put in whatever meat he could find, and have, that would be his dinner for 3 days. And then his lunch would be a piece of bread and an onion, which I couldn't figure out for the longest time. I was like, that sounds like the worst possible food to eat. And I just found out this week, in fact, you know how like the British would send their boats out with limes in them for the, so that the sailors wouldn't get scurvy?
Sure.
Well, another food that is very high in vitamin C is onions. So if you're living at a camp and all you have is brown bread and some cabbage, you eat the onions so you don't get scurvy.
Oh, jeez.
Which was fascinating.
Yeah.
But he said he came to the U.S. and his sister took him to the supermarket and he just wandered around in a daze. And then he becomes very critical in that essay about the way Americans waste food. You know, you go to a dinner and when dinner's over, the dog eats the leftovers, which are more than you had in a week of food. Or just the things that just get discarded, just thrown in the trash. That he had this kind of fixation on paper. He said Americans waste paper. He said you saved every last scrap of newspaper you could because you wrapped everything in it in the Soviet Union. And I think because he was kind of a tough, no-nonsense guy, he also saw a certain kind of like softness to American faith, in part because of the United States being so prosperous. He said, you know, we clung to our faith in the camps. We clung to our faith in these towns in Russia against pretty significant odds and persecution. And then you get to a place where you're allowed to practice your faith freely and people don't come to mass because they were out late the night before, or they treat faith as just one more thing, you know, one more box to check off. And that disturbed him. He was critical of that. The way that just the sort of the way your average family integrated their faith into their lives.
So the book that is being read this Lent by folks through the Hallow app is He Leadeth Me, which before we were recording, you were saying, if you think of kind of with God and Russia, sort of the kind of the history, the memoir piece, like relaying the facts more than He Leadeth Me was more of like kind of the spiritual memoir that he really had wanted to write. So what can you tell us about that book, some of the big themes there? And then maybe we can get into like, why do you think, we could ask Hallow themselves, I guess, but why do you think that would be like a choice for us to read in Lenten season in particular?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, first of all, Chizik didn't, when he first came back, he didn't want to write any of these things. In fact, Flaherty says when he showed up to meet with him, Chizik was like, I don't know what you're doing here. Like, I'm not doing this. But he did then agree. And, you know, With God and Russia is kind of the facts of the of his life. And it is written in sort of a cinematic style, one thing after another. And there was a lot of work that had to be done once they'd gotten everything onto paper. You got to take people's names out. You got to change details because some of these people are still alive, still in prison, still in these camps. And it just was not, I think to Chizik's mind, it wasn't the spiritual reading that he wanted to write. What he wanted to write was an account of how God interacts with your life in these circumstances. And so He Leadeth Me is that book that he would prefer to do. More of a spiritual memoir of his faith, of his of the obstacles he faced in his spiritual life, and you know where God can offer grace. And so it makes sense to me that people would use it for Lenten reading. He's got a style that lends itself to a contemplation on suffering, on you know that is appropriate for Lent, but also these little fervorinos here and there about you know the goodness of God and the rewards of consolation that can appear if you're consistent in your prayer, if you're faithful to what you believe.
Is when you kind of revisit him now and think about him and think of the you know the time that we're in, obviously with a lot of kind of big international questions, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the recent death of Putin's kind of main adversary, I guess, Alexei Navalny, and then kind of think about Chizik in that light. What are some of the things that we think continue to resonate? I'm just curious what Chizik might have to say to us today, kind of decades after he had spent time there. Obviously, different geopolitical realities, but some in some ways, some of the similar stories we get over and over again.
Yeah, and you know, I think that system, I mean, I'm no expert on this, but it appears from these stories about Navalny and other political prisoners in Russia, is that system of prison camps and towns, closed towns up by the Arctic Circle, never really went away. Mm. You know, they changed the names, they changed the security forces, but it's still there. And so I think he would recognize what some of these folks went through. You know, people who were with Navalny said that it's still the same conditions, unheated barracks, freezing cold, hard labor, and people kind of disappearing and reappearing without any rhyme or reason. So that would certainly, I think, be familiar to him. In terms of political positions, I don't think he was particularly political in the sense of, you know, offering commentary on foreign affairs. But he certainly would have recognized the circumstances of this kind of unprovoked invasion of Ukraine that has, you know, been ongoing now for several years, and the suffering that people undergo, and that would be familiar to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, he's working in Poland as sort of a freely traveling around priest, and then one day he's a political prisoner with trumped up charges against him.
Sure.
Would have recognized all that for sure.
So we, in your pieces on him, you again have dipped into the America archive, and that's one of the neat things about America having been around as long as it has, is that when this happened, and America is very tightly bound up in his return and in that story, and obviously in the publication of his work. Are there what else have you found kind of in your kind of spelunking through the archives about him? So we had that one essay he wrote in 64, so not long after his return. Where else is he in the pages? Does he write again in America? Are the books excerpted? It's a neat way to kind of go back in time, is to kind of read, you know, the journalism of the time kind of connected to him. So yeah, what have you found there?
Yeah, well, America, we operate as America Press, and that really was the case back in the 60s. The magazine put out books as well. To be honest, not very high quality paper or binding, but books. So, for example, if you have a copy of Walter Abbott's Documents of Vatican II, it's the famous one with the red cover. That was put out by America Press, and actually Abbott lived at America Magazine. And so the same with He Leadeth Me. I'm sorry, the same with God in Russia. It was originally put out by America Press. And so there was this sort of synergy between the magazine, the book, and Chizik himself. The work he did was more of ecumenical nature, working with Eastern Orthodox and Catholics. And so that was not a particular strength of the magazine or a topic that came up a lot. So by then he was sort of back in the sort of quotidian existence of a Jesuit. But certainly a lot of the guys of that era who worked on the magazine, who led the magazine, were his, you know, friends and classmates and contemporaries in the society. So for example, COVID has destroyed my sense of time, so I don't know if this was 6 weeks ago or 10 years ago, but I went out to Warnersville a few years ago to visit his grave, well, and to see the property. I had never seen it. And in the cemetery, you find his grave. Well, only about 20 feet from him are two guys that I worked with at America in 2008, 2009, George Anderson and Dennis Linehan. So they're all there. You know, I mean, you're looking for a historical figure, and then you see a guy you used to, you know, argue with over breakfast. There was a sort of a closeness of to the relationship between those guys.
And did you hear stories from any of those folks you worked with about what it was like to live with them afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, he was only in the house for a very short time because they moved him out to Warnersville. But yeah, they said he was a kind of a severe guy, kind of taciturn. I don't think first of all, he hadn't spoken English in decades. And then he was someone who didn't speak out of turn ever because of the political circumstances he was in. So, for example, Flaherty said that, you know, he knocked on his door. Chizik opens the door and he says, I've been sent by Father Provincial to work with you. And he said, Chizik just stared at him for about 10 seconds and said, who are you? So he said, I'm here to sit down with you and record your experiences, you know, maybe for a book or for an article. And Chizik looks at him again for about 10 seconds and he says, absolutely not. And so Flaherty leaves, goes back to New York, and then the provincial says, all right, go back on Thursday. And he goes back, and then Chizik, clearly having been read the riot act by the provincial, is now willing to sit down and talk with him. And obviously, I think probably someone explained the rationale, is that you have a story here that is an edifying one, that is one that is an inspirational one. You know, don't let it go out of a sense of modesty or out of a sense of fear.
And it sounded like in that process then of working together, he had a very strong memory. And so in terms of the story is kind of spilling out, as you said, just thousands of pages. And you wonder too, like, I don't know how much, like, you know, what a traumatic experience and what sort of like processing is done. I mean, there's, you know, I guess he has his brothers to talk to, or I can't imagine there was like, if that happened today, the amount of sort of kind of therapeutic options in front of you would be through the roof. But I imagine, as you said, just kind of had to go back, and I wonder how much of that he had to kind of process on his own. I guess maybe that process of writing was a way to kind of work through
it. But, you know, that is, Mike, that is a question that I sometimes wonder. I mean, this is not, they don't discuss things like PTSD in that time. It's just not there. And it reminds me of something I asked my father once. I said, you know, after World War II in Korea, why didn't you have the same phenomenon you had after Vietnam with guys coming back, you know, really with severe PTSD, having a lot of trouble? And my father was like, well, we did. That did happen. We just called it by other things. Shell shock.
Right.
He said, but every bar you ever went into in the late 50s, there were Korean war vets just drinking themselves to death, you know, because of the trauma they had experienced. And it is fascinating to me, too. I don't know what options were available to him. I mean, there are certain analogs in religious life that could work, right? You have things like spiritual direction, confession, spiritual conversation that would help. But yeah, I don't think the guy ever saw a psychologist. I mean, who knows?
But. Gosh, well, Jim Keane, thank you so much for introducing us to Walter Chizik, and we'll make sure again we share your pieces and also Father Chizik's own writing in America and links to places where folks can find out more about him. And hopefully again we piqued some people's interest, and they'll go seek out the books. Is there anything else, I guess, is in the spirit of recommending things? You have the two books that we've talked about. We have some of these pieces we can share. Are there any other good resources out there? Is there a movie? I feel like there should be a movie.
Well, that's actually a funny story. Is a few years ago, we did have contact with someone who wanted to do either a movie or a Netflix special, like a 10-part thing on Chizik. And if you read With God and Russia, you can see why, because it's episodic. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned earlier, Chizik had this incredible memory for detail, probably because he was living more or less internally. You know, every day was sort of reflecting on the events of the day alone, but it's structured like it would make a good miniseries. But the folks who wanted to produce it wanted to find the original manuscript, and of course there was no record of where it was, and so we finally tracked it down. You know, this person talked to this person, and I got a lot of help from the folks at the Jesuit archives at Georgetown. They were very helpful. And we did finally find the original 1,700-page manuscript. But that project, I think, is still technically alive. COVID threw that off a little bit, I think. But there, I think, will eventually be either a miniseries or a movie. And, you know, you see in other movies, if you watch something like The Good Shepherd with Matt Damon, there's a sort of Chizik-esque character there, a defector who turns out not to be actually a defector, but a double agent. And or, you know, Bridge of Spies has some of these prisoner exchanges. So, yes, I think it would make a great movie. I hope they stay true to the story. I mean, I don't want Brad Pitt playing Walter Chizik and, you know, marrying Kate Winslet or something at the end.
Right.
But yes, I think there will eventually be a movie, which, you know, could be fantastic.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait for that. In the meantime, we'll be stuck with the reading, which, you know, hey, nothing wrong with reading, especially for a great writer like yourself. So thanks, Jim, for the time.
Thank you, Mike.
For all you're doing.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for all the good work you do.
AMDG is a production of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States and recorded at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. The show is edited by Marcus Bleach. Our theme music is by Kevin Lasky. The Jesuit Conference communications team is Marcus Bleach, Eric Clayton, Megan Leepsch, Becky Sindelar, and me. Connect with the Jesuits online at jesuits.org, on Twitter at Jesuit News, Instagram at We Are the Jesuits, and facebook.com/Jesuits. Sign up for weekly email reflections by visiting jesuits.org/weekly. If you or someone you know might be called to discern a vocation with the Jesuits, connect with a Jesuit vocation promoter at beajesuit.org. Drop us an email with questions or comments at media@jesuits.org. You can subscribe to AMDG on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as St. Ignatius of Loyola may or may not have said, go and set the world on fire.